where we're told that the sons of Israel were fruitful and increased greatly and multiplied and became exceedingly mighty, so that the land was filled with them. Now a new king arose over Egypt who did not know Joseph. And he said to his people, "Behold, the people of the sons of Israel are more and mightier than we. Come, let us deal wisely with them, lest they multiply, and in the event of war, they also join themselves to those who hate us and fight against us and depart from the land." So they appointed taskmasters over them to afflict them with hard labor. They built for Pharaoh storage cities, Pithom and Ramses. But the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied, and the more they spread out, so that they were in dread of the sons of Israel. And the Egyptians compelled the sons of Israel to labor rigorously, and they made their lives bitter with hard labor and mortar and bricks, and at all kinds of labor in the field, all their labors which they rigorously imposed on them. In these verses, we read about what I'm sure many of you are familiar with, and the kind of a transition, really, from the time of Joseph, when Joseph and his family went down into Egypt, and there they lived for a period of time, and they multiplied there. They really lived in a favored position in a very lush part of Egypt, known as Goshen. They lived there and prospered there, largely in part to the connection they had with Joseph, who had risen, of course, to a very high position within the government of Egypt. But as I said, this is a transitional period. And we see described here the rise of a Pharaoh who didn't know Joseph, and the change in the way that the Egyptians looked upon the people of Israel, and the change of policies, and the less enjoyable kind of circumstances in which Israel lived in Egypt. And so Egypt became to them really a place of difficulty, a place that was unpleasant, a place of hardship. And in many instances, we see then throughout the scriptures that Egypt is referred to in such negative kinds of terms. I came across some commentaries on Egypt and kind of the way that that Egypt is used in the scriptures. One man cited what he called the law of first use. And what he said was that if you find the first time in the scriptures that something is mentioned, and that's the way it's used then throughout the rest of scriptures. And so he said the first instance that we really read about Egypt is back in the book of Genesis in the time of Abraham, and how Abraham, because of famine in the land of Canaan where he was sojourning, he went down into Egypt. And there were some unpleasant experiences down there, and therefore Egypt is cast in a negative light and ought to always be looked upon in a negative light as you go through scriptures. I find a little difficulty in accepting that notion. One, because when Abraham went down into Egypt, the negative things that happened were because of Abraham, not because of the Egyptians. You read in Genesis chapter 12 where Abraham lies to Pharaoh and tells him that, and the rest of the Egyptians, that Sarah is his sister, because he feared what they might do to him because she was a beautiful woman, and wanting to take her for themselves that they might kill him. Well, all of that was due to what Abraham did. Really wasn't due to what the Egyptians did on that occasion. Furthermore, Egypt is not always cast in a negative light in the scriptures. The very story of Joseph is one in which he's taken down to Egypt, of course, in negative circumstances, those produced by his brothers, but he's taken as a slave there, but he's raised up to a high level of position, as we talked about. And indeed, when another famine strikes the land of Canaan, it's his family that comes down into Egypt, and you know how the story goes of how they're reunited. And Egypt really becomes a bit of a sanctuary almost for them, and they prosper there They live well and they do well in Egypt. Now, things did turn negatively, as the text that we've just read describes. But again, it's not cast in the light of being an evil place. You fast forward a number of centuries, and it's to Egypt that Joseph takes Mary and the new child, newborn child, Jesus, for sanctuary once again until Herod dies and it's safe for them to return to their land. Again, Egypt is not really portrayed in those circumstances, brief as the scriptures may be on what they say about Jesus being in Egypt in that time. Egypt is not portrayed in that negative kind of light. It is true, however, as you read through the scriptures and you consider what the scriptures say about Egypt, in particular what they have to say about the relationship to Israel, the nation of Israel, that Egypt is a place that is cast in negative terms. And it's in those terms that I want to speak to you about this evening for a few moments, about the lure that Egypt had of all people, surprisingly so, for the people of Israel. Because as negative as their experiences were, after 400 years there, when they finally are delivered out of this bondage that's described in chapter 1, when they're finally delivered from that, we see over and over again a draw, a lure, a pull that Egypt seemed to have for the people of Israel. And I want to draw some comparisons, if I may, in our study, to the kind of lure and draw, the pull that the world has to those who are God's children today. And I believe that there are some parallels that we can draw between those two. You know, Egypt, as we said, starts out as being a place where we see Israel is dominated by this place and by the people of this place. We've read there in verses 8 through 14 of the painful experiences that the people of Israel had, the suffering that they endured in that place. All that's bound up in the relationship that they had, where they were held in bondage. They were kept as slaves there. You know, there's a very similar way in which the scriptures describe the world and the relationship of the world and Christians. You turn over to the book of Ephesians in the second chapter, and in the first three verses, there the Apostle Paul writes this: "You were dead in your trespasses and sins, in which you formerly walked, according to the course of this world, according to the prince of the power of the air, of the spirit that is now working in the sons of disobedience. Among them, we too all formerly lived in the lusts of our flesh, indulging the desires of the flesh and of the mind, and were by nature children of wrath, even as the rest." When Paul describes the former life of these Christians, he describes it in the terms of being a people who were walking according to the course of this world. And we see this borne out in the New Testament many, many times. The warnings about the world, the admonitions such as those made by the Apostle John, not to love this world or the things that are in the world. And he says the things that are in the world are the lust of the eye, the lust of the flesh, and the pride of life. Now, we need to understand that in these warnings, that the writers of the New Testament are not saying, when they talk about the world, they're not talking about this globe. They're not talking about this creation of God's, but rather they're talking about the system of this world, a domain that is ruled over, as Paul describes in Ephesians chapter 2, by the prince of the power of the air. He is the God, he is described, Satan is described in other scriptures as being the god of this world. It is of this system, this evil that he rules over, that the scriptures refer to as world. And worldliness, then, is a manner of living that is accustomed to the things of this world and practices the things of this world, the lust of the eyes, the lust of the flesh, the pride of life. This is what we're drawing the comparison to this evening, between the world in which we all, who are Christians tonight, formerly lived. We formerly occupied that place. Just as the Israelites at one time in bondage were held in Egypt, we too were held in bondage, as the scriptures speak about sin as being a bondage, a spiritual bondage that men and women are held in until they are freed through Jesus Christ. But not only do we see this pain associated with Egypt that Israel experienced, but we also see the progression of this bondage in which they were held. Look in Exodus chapter 5, if you would. Exodus chapter 5, and in verses 5 and following, here Moses writes that again Pharaoh said, "Look, the people of the land are now many, and you would have them cease from their labors." He's speaking here, of course, to Moses, after Moses had begun to demand the release of Israel. So we continue on in verse 6. "So the same day Pharaoh commanded the taskmasters over the people and their foremen, saying, 'You are no longer to give the people straw to make brick as previously. Let them go and gather straw for themselves. But the quota of bricks which they were making previously, you shall impose on them. You are not to reduce any of it, because they are lazy. Therefore they cry out, "Let us go and sacrifice to our God." Let the labor be heavier on the men, and let them work at it, that they may pay no attention to false words." You know, Pharaoh reacts to this demand of Moses by saying, "Well, I'm just going to make things tougher on your people. Oh, they're lazy. They're asking to go, be released, go so they can go and worship their God because they're lazy. And so I'm going to make things harder on them," particularly verse 9. He says, "so that they pay no attention to false words." Well, what false words? The words that God had spoken. The words that God had told Moses to go and to demand the release of his people. To Pharaoh, these were false words. And the Israelites needed to be persuaded, "Oh, you ought not to listen to that." Now, is that not reminiscent also of the way of world, of worldliness, the way of the world in relationship to those who are Christians, to those who even struggle with worldliness and with the way of the world? The way of worldliness always gets worse. It always gets harder. In fact, the wise man says in Proverbs that the way of the transgressor is hard. And that is so oftentimes the case. It's always that way for those who are trapped in worldliness. Their addictions grow stronger over time. They find themselves more deeply rooted in the world and in its ways. The evil that they become involved in grows worse and worse. You've heard the admonitions that are offered many times in lessons and Bible classes and in sermons about sin will keep you longer than you intended to stay. It will cost you more than you intended to expend. It will take you farther than you intended to go. All of those things are true about worldliness and the way of worldliness. They were true for the people of Israel as well, as they were held in Egypt. But also, I think we ought to take note of the fact that this, while they were held in this time, this hard place, this place of bondage, it was also a time when their deliverer came to them. In Exodus chapter 2, and in verse 10. You'll notice where it's really the conclusion of a description of several verses that precede this about the birth of Moses. But verse 10 says that the child grew, and she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son, and she named him Moses and said, "Because I drew him out of the water." I suspect that you're familiar with that story of how Moses' parents sought to save him from Pharaoh's decree that all of the children being born to the Israelites should be killed. And so they made a little ark for him, and they put him, this little newborn infant, into that ark and put it into the river. And it was providentially found by the daughter of Pharaoh, and she saves him, and she raises him as her son. She names him Moses. But this deliverer of the people, who many years later would come back and demand the release of Israel from Egypt, came to them in a time when they were being held in that bondage. You think about what Scripture says about Jesus, that while we were yet what? While we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. He came to us in our condition of being held in bondage to sin, of being in this world, in the grips of worldliness and the ways of worldliness. Our deliverer came to us at such a time as that. But not only do we see in the considering Egypt and the things that happened there that Israel was dominated by Egypt, we also see that Israel, of course, was eventually delivered from Egypt. They were delivered, first of all, by the plan of God. We won't take the time to look at it, but you can read chapters 3 and 4 in the book of Exodus. And you know how God calls Moses and tells him that he's to go back to Egypt and he's to demand the release of Israel. The plan of our deliverance from the grips of this world. The plan of our deliverance from the bondage of sin was a plan that was thought up by God long before our deliverer ever came. Just as he had thought up the plan of delivering Israel long before Moses was ever born. You can look back in the book of Genesis in the 15th chapter in verses 13 and 14. And read there where God speaks to Abraham. Abraham's asking him a question. How do I know? You've promised me this great nation of people that are going to arise from me. How do I know that these things are going to really come to pass? And God begins to tell him what's going to happen. And in verses 13 and 14, he tells him how his descendants, the descendants of Abraham, are going to go down into this foreign land, and they're going to be held as slaves in this place, but that they are going to be delivered. God had that plan in mind long before Moses was ever born. Just as God had a plan of deliverance for people out of this world, out of the bondage of sin, long before Jesus was ever born. Ephesians, the first chapter, in verses 3 and 4, the Apostle Paul writes about the fact that it was before the foundation of the world that God had predetermined that there was going to be a deliverance made in this fashion. Through Jesus, his son. We, like they, the Israelites, were delivered by a plan formed by God. And it was a deliverance that came about by virtue of the power of God. Chapter 5 through chapter 13 in the book of Exodus describes that confrontation that went on between Pharaoh and Moses, and how it was God, through the exercise of his power, bringing these 10 plagues upon Egypt, brought that nation and that arrogant king to his knees, to the point that he finally had to acknowledge there is a greater power at work here than I am able to resist, and he had to let the people go. But it was not by Moses' power. It was not by the power of the people of Israel, who we've already read have grown in number and in size to the point that the Egyptians are worried about their power. But it was not by their accumulated power together that their deliverance was gained. It was solely by the power of God. Just as deliverance from the world and from the effects of worldliness, they too are, or we too, are delivered by the power of God. It does not come about by human reasoning. It doesn't come about by virtue of human goodness, by human deeds. It's the work of God. He formulated the plan. He provided the Savior. He calls the sinner. He saves the sinner. He preserves the sinner who is converted out of this world. It is all by virtue of His power. And also, the people of Israel, as they were delivered by the power of God, did so with praises to God. Look in Exodus, the 14th chapter, if you would, as you begin to read about their departure from Egypt. In chapter 14 and in verse 8, there we're told that the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and he chased after the sons of Israel as the sons of Israel were going out boldly. You'll remember the story of how Pharaoh gave his approval to Moses, take the people, leave, take everything you've got, get out of here. And then after they began to leave, he began to have second thoughts. And so here we read about how he's determined, now I'm going to go chase them down. But notice what is said about the way the people are leaving. It is said that they were leaving boldly. They left Egypt behind, praising the Lord. They were redeemed. They were excited about the fact that they were redeemed. They were grateful and appreciative of the fact that they were redeemed. Do you remember, those of you that are Christians, do you remember the occasion of your deliverance from the world? Do you remember that time when you obeyed the gospel of Christ? You think about Acts, the 8th chapter, and the record of the evangelist Philip preaching to the Ethiopian eunuch. And after the eunuch is baptized and Philip goes on his way and the eunuch continues on his way back to his home, it says that he went on his way rejoicing. Can you think back and remember that time when you were grateful, appreciative? Do you remember that time when you were excited by the deliverance that you had? Well, of course, that ought to be retained throughout our lives. Does it feel that real tonight? Well, it should. It should for every one of us. But not only do we see Israel, though, delivered, but we also see, after their deliverance, a desire that they maintained, a desire that they maintained, seemingly, for Egypt. Even though they had experienced such a great deliverance, Israel continued to have this strange attraction, this pull for Egypt. They desired Egypt for a number of different reasons. They desired Egypt, I would say, for the sense of safety that it provided. The 14th chapter and verses 10 through 12, Pharaoh drew near the sons of Israel, looked, and behold, the Egyptians were marching after them, and they became very frightened. So the sons of Israel cried out to the Lord. Then they said to Moses, "Is it because there were no graves in Egypt that you have taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you dealt with us in this way, bringing us out of Egypt? Is this not the word that we spoke to you in Egypt, saying, 'Leave us alone that we may serve the Egyptians'? For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the wilderness." Where do you think these people thought they were the safest? Right there on the shores of the Red Sea, with the sea to their backs and now the approaching armies of Pharaoh, Is that where they were the safest? Or did they have the sense that, no, you know, really we were safer, we were better off back in Egypt? Well, it seems to me that it's pretty clear that what they're saying to Moses is, we were better off back in Egypt. Things were a bit more secure. Things were a bit more reliable. We knew what to expect back then. You ever felt yourself, or maybe you've dealt with Christians who were new Christians, new converts, and they come to that point where they experience their first opposition to their new faith. Maybe it comes from their friends. Maybe it comes from someone in their family. Maybe it comes from the co-workers, and people begin to mock, and people begin to say hurtful things and harsh things about their new faith, and they just wither under that. It's one of the things that we need to be careful to do in our efforts to teach people the truth, and that is to prepare them for the fact that they're going to face this kind of opposition, this kind of criticism. The Egyptians seemed to pose an unexpected threat to Israel on this occasion in Exodus chapter 14. We need to not be taken unawares that the world is going to oppose us. We have very plainly described to us an enemy, one who seeks our destruction, whose every effort and every thought is given to how he can harm us spiritually. We need to be aware of the fact that he's real, he exists. And just like Pharaoh's intention was to destroy Israel, his intention is to destroy us also. But these people also seem to have a desire for the supplies of Egypt. In the 16th chapter of Exodus, verses 2 and 3 says, the whole congregation of the sons of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. The sons of Israel said to them, would that we had died by the Lord's hand in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the pots of meat, when we ate bread to the full. For you have brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger. Now this is just a short time after they have been delivered from right there on the banks of the Red Sea. God opened the sea and they crossed the land on dry land. And when Pharaoh and his armies pursued them, God destroyed them, bringing the waters of the Red Sea back on. They're delivered. No need to fear the threat. But now here they are, and now they're hungry. Oh, you know, I sure do miss that meat back in Egypt. You ever look back upon those days before you were a Christian with fondness? Think about, oh, you know, how much fun it was. You could just do anything you wanted to do. Say anything you wanted to say. Act any way that you wanted to act. Boy, those were the good old days, weren't they? Well, that's exactly what these Egyptians are thinking. And what sometimes, unfortunately, Christians can come to think as the lure of the world has its effect upon us. Oh, it's so hard being a Christian. And I guarantee you that and agree that there are challenges to being a Christian. There's no question about that. There are some difficulties associated with being a Christian. But where in the world are we better off? With the Lord? Or back in the good old days when we were with the devil? We can long for the supplies of this world, just like the Israelites longed for the supplies of Egypt. They also longed for the spirits of Egypt. You turn over to the 32nd chapter, and we see where Moses has gone up into the mount. They're encamped around Mount Sinai, and he's gone up into the mountain to speak with God, to receive from God the commands that are going to guide the people from this day onward. And he's up there for an extended period of time, longer than the people thought he would be. And they begin to think, well, he must have died up there. Something's happened. Verse 1 of chapter 32 says, "Now when the people saw that Moses delayed to come down from the mountain, the people assembled about Aaron and said to him, 'Come, make us a God who will go before us. As for this Moses, the man who brought us up out in the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him.'" Well, we're just not going to follow Moses anymore. We don't know what happened to him. And so what we need to do is we need to make ourselves gods that we can follow. And so they begin to corrupt the form of God. They begin to corrupt what they have had revealed to them about the nature of God and about their responsibilities to God. They begin to corrupt their agreement that they've previously made back in the 20th chapter of Exodus about living according to the covenant of God. Is that not what happens to Christians many times? We become uncertain about following, just being determined to follow Jesus. We become concerned and thinking, well, for a variety of reasons, well, that just doesn't seem to be popular with people. We can't seem to convince very many people to come and join us in following Jesus. So maybe what we need to do is change and alter some things about what it means to follow Jesus. So we begin to alter things of the faith that we've had revealed to us. We begin to form for ourselves a new and a different understanding about the Lord. Not only did these folks seem to long for the spirits of Egypt, or the gods of Egypt, they also seem to long for the stability of Egypt. Numbers chapter 21. As we continue to fast forward through the history of the people of Israel, Numbers chapter 21, verses 4 and 5. It says, "They set out from Mount Hor by the way of the Red Sea to go around the land of Edom, and the people became impatient because of the journey. And the people spoke against God and Moses, 'Why have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? For there is no food, no water, and we loathe this miserable food.'" Well, isn't it interesting what these folks do? As they look back with favor upon those good old days in Egypt, what is it that they do? They begin to criticize not just Moses, but they begin to criticize God. They criticize the way that they're having to go. The text says they became what? They became impatient. How many times are we as Christians urged in our walk of faith to make our way through this life with patience, with endurance? But oftentimes we grow impatient and we soon lose our determination to follow the ways of God, to live in the ways of God. And we find ourselves even criticizing the ways of God, even to the point like these folks. We begin to criticize our deliverer. They criticized Moses. And we can even come to the point where we begin to criticize our Savior and His ways, to the point that we refuse to worship Him. Finally, we do see Israel not only desiring Egypt, but eventually dying to Egypt. I find this interesting that, you know, basically there are two ways that these folks could have died to Egypt. One was the way in which most of them died.